Cosmos Science, news, magazine, podcasts, video and features.
Welcome to Cosmos Country, where our reporters talk about dealing with climate change in rural and regional Australia.
The climate system is complicated. If you do something in one place, it can have effects somewhere else.
Our first species released beyond the fence on the sanctuary was brush-tailed possum, and they've done really well, which is incredibly exciting.
Prosperity and education, they're our values, and everything that we do relates to that.
So that's an absolute game changer.
Hi, Glenn Morrison with you again for another Cosmos Country, where we discuss how rural and regional Australia is dealing with climate change. Dr. Thomas Fellows joins me from Sydney University's School of Geosciences. So the research we're talking about today concerns low-lying coral reef islands, which you say are at risk. Can you tell us firstly, what is a low-lying coral reef island and why are they in danger?
Yeah, that's a great question to start off with. So a low-lying coral reef island is an island that forms on top of a living coral reef with sediments from the living reef itself. So they're made of skeletons and shells of different living biota, and they're usually within a couple of meters of sea level. So that's the low-lying aspect of it. And they're found right across the tropics on reefs across the world.
Can you give us an example of some in Australian waters?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the most well-known area would probably be the islands on the Great Barrier Reef. There's plenty of low-lying islands there, but there are other islands that are further offshore, which are the ones that I research. So further east in the Coral Sea, there are a lot of coral islands, as well as the northwest shelf of Western Australia. And then overseas territories such as the Cocos Keeling Islands in the Indian Ocean as well.
Now, these are in my mind at least, distinct from things like Lady Musgrave Island, Green Island, Hamilton Island, things like that. They seem like more substantial islands. Am I correct there, or can you explain the difference between the two?
Lady Musgrave is a low-lying island as well, so it's the same type of island as these ones. Places like Lizard or Hamilton and stuff, which have continental or larger sort of island areas that are made of different types of rock, such as, you know, continental rock or volcanic, et cetera, like we have in the Pacific. These ones are pretty much 100% derived from the skeletons of the reefs. And the reason they're low-lying is because the sediment is broken away by waves and storms and then transported onto the reef. So sea level plays an extremely important part in how high these islands can get. That's why they're low-lying.
And hence why they're at risk?
Yeah, so they're unconsolidated sediments. They might be made of rubble or sand or a combination of the two. But the sort of premise is that they're unconsolidated. So it's loose sediment that is transported there by waves and currents. So they're dynamic. So they change based on various pressures, being sea level rise or if there's a storm event or bleaching and other things like that.
So you say that some of these islands at least could be wiped out by climate change. What specifically do you mean there? Are there other factors operating that are putting them at risk as well?
Yeah, so I guess in terms of climate change being not just one threat, it's a combination of threats. So that's kind of what this paper really does. It brings those biological threatening and physical processes together. But what we mean by sort of destabilizing islands is that are they going to succumb to the compound effects of climate change? Is sea level rise going to flood them? Are storms then going to be able to erode them? Things like that. These are the questions we really need to answer, because it is quite hard to put a timescale on it, but we know that the processes are intensifying, so we need to have a really good understanding of what's going on now to be able to predict how they're going to respond in the future.
Right. So is it mainly that they would become submerged in sea level rise, or are there other sorts of damage like wave action from cyclones, acidification, those sorts of things? Can you give us a picture of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess when we're talking about these threats that you've just mentioned, we're talking about processes that are happening on different scales. So a storm is quite a short time scale event. It can erode, it may even bring new sediment to the reef, to the island. Then we look at things like slower processes like sea level rise, relatively slower. that the islands themselves could change into a different state if the water is higher, more wave energy can reach the shore of the island, maybe the island changes to a new state. So that's kind of the idea that with the physical process, when we talk about the sort of connection between the living reef and the islands themselves, that's where acidification, coral bleaching, marine heat waves, those kinds of threats are a little less understudied in the terms of the stability of islands, because they impact the living reef that supplies the sediment. So that is sort of the really thing that I love bringing together, is this idea of a living reef and a non-living, or, you know, deceased material creating an island and that link. So that's where this new research brings together all of those things in proxy form to identify risks and exposures. So my research is about the stability and vulnerability of low-lying coral reef islands. And I've just had a paper come out called Risk Classification of Low-Lying Coral Reef Islands and Their Exposures to Climate Threats.
You're listening to Cosmos Country. I'm Marie Lowe, regular presenter based in Gunnedah, northern New South Wales, a land of wide open skies and agriculture with a side of mining. I love country town life and the genuine people you find here, as well as living somewhere where there is nothing between you and the sunset. Now we're seeing the changes in our lives and in our land as our climate evolves. That's Cosmos Country.
Thomas, I understand there are some 65 million people living on these sorts of reefs worldwide, which is a lot. Where are they mostly? And the ones that are in Australian waters that you're describing, are there any with people living on them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that 65 million people, that's a UN estimate. And the majority of the people that live on these islands, we call SIDS communities, so small island developing states, predominantly in the Pacific region and Southeast Asia as well, there are a few, and some in the Caribbean, but the majority is the Southwest, that is the Pacific. Yeah. Now, in the Australian context, the Cocos Keeling have a permanent population who live on them in the order of around 600 people in the last census. Yeah.
So the Cocos Keeling Islands are at risk of inundation?
So they are low-lying, so they're only a couple of metres above sea level. Those islands are quite large. They're on like an atoll, like a traditional sort of ring atoll with islands around it. They are exposed to heat waves and storms and things like that. But the fact is that those islands have also got people living on them. They've been slightly engineered. And so in terms of their risk, we still don't understand the timescale until it may be inundated. There is ongoing research in that area at the moment for the Cocos, given that it is a strategically important place for Australia.
So you talk about the risk to the islands.
Yeah.
And you've done a kind of a strategic and almost numerical analysis of risk. Can you describe that? It's kind of like a ranking, isn't it?
Yeah, so given that coral islands have a very broad range of characteristics, they may be exposed to very different conditions on a local or regional scale. The whole sort of premise of this methodology, this new classification, was to look at the most important factors that dictate risk or vulnerability. And then on a scale of, say, 1 to 5, 1 being the lowest, 5 the highest, rank each island based on their exposures. So, for example, sea level rise. If sea level rise was lower than the global average, we assign a lower risk value. If it's higher, we give a higher one. And through that sort of simplified process, we did it for various threats and various characteristics, and that gave us a total value. We could sum it together, and it would give us a number. And then from that number, we could then look at breaking those out as different classes of risk, so very low through to very high.
So do you have any feedback on how useful people think this might be at a strategic decision-making level?
Yeah, absolutely. So like this study just looks at 56 islands, but we use open access imagery and climate models. So it has global application. You could use it on any island. But in the Australian context, this project was funded by the Australian government, Geoscience Australia, and they wanted a way to identify the most at-risk islands, that offshore islands that support Australia's maritime zone, maritime jurisdiction. So it was a method of being able to focus in on the at-risk islands, and then that will inform them and their decisions going forward with how to manage these systems.
It's almost like I remember the mangrove assessment studies from years ago that did a similar thing, some environmental management studies of managing coastal waterways. Is this a model that's familiar to coastal managers?
So using sort of a risk matrix where you can assign, you combine two different aspects to make an output like a rating is not new, but this is the first research that has specifically focused it on low-lying islands. It's been used in other coastal management strategies, but we've just kind of tweaked it to those parameters that really are important for island stability, such as sea level rise, acidification, et cetera.
So I understand there are some issues of kind of, how would you say it, marine territory and jurisdictional issues. Would you mind explaining what they are and how these islands might affect that or be involved in that discussion?
Yeah, absolutely. So at sort of a high level, so there's the UN Convention Law of the Sea, which was in the 80s. Most countries in the world signed up to that. And within that legal framework, there is a clause that states that if you have a reef with an island on it, and that is part of your sovereign nation, you can draw maritime zones from that reef and island to up to 200 nautical miles. Now, we've seen in the Pacific, obviously, that's an extremely important thing to delineate or to have boundaries with your neighbours. But in the Australian context, these features actually provide 15% of Australia's maritime jurisdiction across those zones I've spoken about. And that's a very large, it's about 1.2 million square kilometres. And in the jurisdictional space, it gives us rights to navigation, fisheries, et cetera.
So are you saying that if those small islands disappear beneath the waves, then we might lose rights to those territorial waters?
So that is one of the legal theories. It is very much up to debate. But yes, the idea of how to draw these zones is based on the fact that an island is above high water mark. So if you move that high water mark, there is potential risk to losing those zones. The way that states or countries implement or interpret that law is very different, and the legal scholars will be able to describe that a bit more.
And I'm interpolating here, but that could affect things like fisheries and fishing rights and exploration rights and all sorts of things, could it not?
Yes, they seem to be extremely hot topics at the moment, given what's going on, COP28, et cetera. But in terms of, the transition to no fossil fuels, needing rare earth elements, things like this to make batteries, there's a lot of these minerals that are out there in the oceans. And they're very important resources for all countries, including Australia. So, if there was a scenario where these islands disappeared or were inundated or something like that, it would raise questions about how Australia would remain as it is.
You're listening to Cosmos Country. I'm Jamie Seidel, one of your regular presenters. While currently an Adelaide-based city slicker, I've lived in the old outback mining town of Lee Creek, the energy hub of Port Augusta, and the regional centre of Murray Bridge. But my heart remains in McLean's hometown of Crystal Brook. Having watched climate change unfold from a contentious academic warning to a lived experience, I'm fascinated to see how the inherent resilience of our rural communities is rising to this new challenge. That's Cosmos Country.
And you said that you work at a place called One Tree Island off Queensland, which sounds wonderful. Can you tell us a bit about what it's like there?
Yeah, absolutely. So One Tree Island Research Station is a facility of the University of Sydney. It's turning 50 this year or next year, so it's been managed for 50 years. And it is a tiny rubble island that sits on a reef that's about 5 by 3 kilometres. And the maximum elevation of that one is around 2 metres, 2 and a bit metres above sea level. And because the university has a station there, we're able to take students and do our own research there as well. And we've been looking in the past at historical imagery and mapping the changes to One Tree. And we've shown that even islands like Mr. Made of Rubble are dynamic as well. They get moved around by storms, et cetera. But it's a beautifully pristine environment there where you can only, it's a science zone. So you have to be a scientist to go there. So luckily, it's not been too bleached by the last few years, but fingers crossed it's okay this year with the impending summer we have.
I've always thought you scientists kept the best places to yourselves.
Sometimes.
So You say in the paper that the risk matrix will help identify adaptive measures, so adapting to these risks, adapting to climate change. Other than putting an island on stilts, what can be done?
Absolutely. So the one of the key take-homes from this paper is that no island had zero risk. So they all had some degree of risk, which is a really important thing to know. But being able to identify, in this example, 25% that are at more risk will inform people such as the government or coastal managers to go, okay, well, we need to go there, collect data, maybe take imagery, understand what's going on now before it's too late and something happens or it changes. But in terms of adaptation, just ensuring that the living reef is maintained is equally as important as the structural stability of the island itself.
What's the difference between, say, the Great Barrier Reef, the reefs on there, and these sorts of reef islands in terms of their ecological and scientific importance?
Yeah, that's a great question. So these islands that I've been looking at are generally oceanic islands. They're further offshore than, say, the Great Barrier Reef. And that, from an ecological perspective at a high level, is that they're not always as close to the shore where the waters can get a bit warmer in these sort of bleaching events. But it's a double-edged sword. Like, it's very hard to get to these remote locations. So the data is a bit lacking compared to the reef, where we have 30-odd years of annual data showing how they're changing. So we have to kind of use the information and the processes or the, you know, what's going on in the Great Barrier Reef to then go, okay, well, maybe this is also going on there. And that's an extremely good place to sort of go, okay, well, let's put more effort into research in the offshore locations. Maybe they become refugee for future reefs.
How many of these low-lying coral reef islands are there around Australia?
That's a great question. So the quick answer is we don't actually know. So there are generally maps of the Great Barrier Reef and others, but there are some very small islands that may not have been picked up historically with satellite imagery and things like that. So the estimate is somewhere in sort of like 500, 700, that sort of space. But in this study, we're looking at the offshore ones, which have been mapped because they have strategic importance. And we looked at 56, but there are more islands, but they were representative of the types of islands you find across the whole of Australia.
So when you say they have strategic importance, was that related to the jurisdictional matters that we discussed?
Yeah, that's correct. So this research was funded by the Maritime Governance Department of Geoscience Australia. So they were interested in what mechanisms threat coral reefs, how long do we have, and what can we do kind of thing to fix it? Yeah.
Thanks very much for that. That was great.
No worries.